I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Marinus and Robert Samuels from the Washington Post, David is associate editor there, spent 35 days traveling the U.S. interviewing American voters as they decided who to support, and some deciding or already actively campaigning for their candidate in this 2016 presidential race. It's a four-part series titled Looking for America. What's happening in America? What does it mean to be an American? These are questions defining a campaign unlike any other, they write. Crossed the nation, they did both journalists looking for answers, and this is what they found. It's a very extensive, interesting and beautifully written four-part series, and it talks about issues that are important, about anger in America, about whether or not there are historical parallels here, particularly to 1968. They ask about ask disgruntled people, but also talk to people who feel that, you know, things are different in America, but there is hope for a brighter future. It's a very, very beautiful series, and if you haven't seen it, it will be on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. It's definitely worth a read, as is most everything by David Marinus. David, of course, has strong Wisconsin ties, living some of the time of the year in Madison, and a graduate of UW-Madison. He is the author of six wonderful books, Barack Obama, The Story When Pride Still Mattered, A Life of Vince Lombardi, First in the Class, A Biography of Bill Clinton, They Marched Into Sunlight, War and Peace, Vietnam and America, October of 1967, Clemente, The Passion and Grace of Baseball's Last Hero, and Rome, 1960, The Summer Olympics That Stirred the World. He joined us last to talk about his book, Detroit, A Love Story, which just won the Robert F. Kennedy Book Award. He's a three-time Pulitzer Prize finalist and won the Pulitzer for National Reporting in 93 for his paper's coverage of then presidential candidate Bill Clinton. We'll be welcoming phone calls for David as we look for America this hour of the show. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. David, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Always great to be with you, Kathleen.
I love this series. It's just it's just so good. It's beautifully written, but it sort of gets to, we talk around a lot of issues, and you really, I think, get to some important truths about what's happening this year, and congratulations for it. It's beautifully done.
I'm not sure if anybody can explain totally what's happening this year, but we tried.
I know. Well, you make a comparison, and tell me how, take it as far as you want to, with 1968, anti-war protesters clashing with the police in Chicago, multi-ethnic assembly of demonstrators colliding with Donald Trump in 2016. Are there historical comparisons here, and what are they?
It's always dangerous to try to make too close of a parallel with history. We, of course, always repeat the mistakes of the past, but that doesn't mean that everything is exactly the same. But in the sense that everything seems to be up in the air and nobody knows quite where we're going. And there are some pretty deep cultural divisions in both parties. This year, I think those are, and there's an undertone of menace, particularly from Mr. Trump and his supporters, that in some ways is redolent of different eras of the past, from the McCarthy era to the George Wallace era to present.
And you start the whole series with this talk about the anger that's out there. So much anger out there in America. What kind of anger surprised you, or did you expect to find the anger that you found?
You know, what surprised me the most was the anger that I didn't find, which was among people who have the most justification for being angry. But there's an historical parallel to that, or resonance to it, and those tended to be Hispanic, Latina, and African-American women. You know, probably the subgroups that have been the most discriminated against and have had to deal with the most over the longest period of time were the most optimistic. I guess it maybe shouldn't have surprised me, but it did. In terms of the anger, I don't know that I was surprised. I mean, I know I've always believed that race is the central dilemma of American life, and I think that you know, the anger, whether it's from the Black Lives Matter movement or the Trump movement, in very, very different ways, the issues revolve around race and the other, the fear of the other.
Take us to the area near Detroit, which is now Trump Democrats, used to be Reagan Democrats, because you can look at the issue of race in that particular community and figure out race and how it may factor into the Trump campaign or support for him.
Sure. Well, you know, there's always more to it than just race, but I think race is at the center of much of it. But that's Macomb County. It's a largely, but not entirely, working-class county to the north of Detroit. It's a county that was studied scrupulously by Bill Clinton's pollsters, Stan Greenberg, in preparation for Clinton's elections, as the home of the Reagan Democrats, and why the white working class turned against the Democratic Party. And so I went back up there, and now it's, I don't know if you call them Trump Democrats. I think they're Trump people. I don't know what party they are. I mean, it's not really, it's sort of a rebellion against the traditional parties. But many of the same issues and frustrations that were there evident during the Reagan era and going back before that to George Wallace's success in the Michigan primaries in the late 1960s and early 1970s. So it's a combination of people feeling left out by the demographic changes of the country, in various ways hurt by the economic changes and the different trade bills that have affected employment in that part of Michigan, although that's actually just a small part of the larger transformation of the economy that affected them. And a feeling that other people are getting more than they are, whether that's true or not. So all of that sort of led to the frustrations of the Trump voters that are now prevalent in Macomb County.
I think it was one of the voters in Macomb, it may have been elsewhere, I can't remember, but who was complaining about all the free stuff that other people are getting. I've heard that phrase before, David, and I wonder what free stuff they're referring to.
Well, you know, it's the free stuff that they're getting, too.
Ah.
But they don't like it when other people are getting it. But, you know, that's been true for a long time. But if you actually study the Tea Party voter or the Trump voter, you'll find that they're getting as much government support as anybody in various ways. But they just don't like it when anyone else is getting it. And basically anyone else means blacks and Hispanics to a large degree.
Mm-hmm.
So that goes back to the whole issue of race again. But what are they talking about? You know, it can range from welfare, although that's been limited greatly over the last 20 years, to even Medicare and Medicaid, which a lot of these people are on. So there's always a gap between the specificity of their frustrations and the reality of their frustrations.
And there's this, I'm wondering how widespread this feeling was when you talk to people. There's this really poignant interview with this young guy who I think is a senior in high school, and he's a Trump supporter.
Yeah.
And his favorite television show was The Apprentice, and he just really looks at Donald Trump as being the kind of strong leader that he hopes to be someday. He's just kind of shy now, but I almost feel like Trump is lifting him up and saying, you can do this, you can do this.
Yeah, that was Jason Pozarek from St. Clair County in Michigan, and you know, you're right. It was kind of poignant, and I really liked this kid. And he was very earnest and, you know, was a very good student at school. And his social studies teacher in high school didn't agree with him but respected him for what he, you know, what his act is being active in politics. And Jason was not unlike a lot of Trump people that I met, in the sense that it was the apprentice that drew him to Donald Trump. You know, we sort of forget that more people knew Trump than any of these other candidates.
I know.
More people watch television than care about politics.
Right.
And so, you know, whenever anybody says, well, Trump came out of nowhere, or, you know, he didn't really. He came out of the modern culture, for better or worse, the reality TV culture, which is, you know, one of the many factors that led to the sort of eruption or implosion this year in the Republican Party.
Hmm.
So Jason was part of that. And that led me to a couple of other ideas. You know, not just that people were attracted to Trump because of sort of the religion of success, but this wasn't the case with Jason, but with some other people that I started thinking about, was why would evangelicals be attracted to Donald Trump? You know, a thrice divorced,
yeah,
you know, libertine and, you know, egomaniac. I mean, you know, it's not the meek shall inherit the earth with Donald Trump. It's the opposite. So
right.
What is the religion aspect to him? There isn't really any, except that I found kind of a connection between worship of wealth and the megachurches. Mm. The evangelical megachurches, many of which preach sort of the connection between belief and financial success. And so these people who like The Apprentice or go to these arenas that fill up with promoters talking about you too can become a millionaire.
Right.
It's not really that different from going to a megachurch.
Yeah, people have been doing that for some time, haven't they, David? If pray hard enough for what it is you want, if you pray, you'll be able to get it.
Absolutely. And so there is that connection there, which wasn't apparent to me at first, but when I started, the more I talked to people, it sort of became obvious.
Mm. To me, it's eye-opening, and I don't quite know how to get into the Trump mindset, because I must say that I know that he was a reality television show star, but I haven't seen those shows, David. I know that he had a best-selling The Apprentice was a big deal, and I know who he was, but I've never watched very much of that.
Well,
so
neither did I. I mean, there's a lot of American culture that is foreign to me and to a lot of people.
Yes.
And, you know, the reality TV is one of those. Professional wrestling is another one. I think there's a connection
right
there. It's a lot of the same people. But, you know, that's not to invalidate these cultural phenomenon. It's just that I'm not familiar with them.
Right. And the whole entrance, the whole way it's orchestrated with the plane and the way he shows up and he's at the microphone and he's talking, as you write about in the piece, about the president was going to have $1 billion plane. Can you imagine that? I can make a deal. Everything's making a deal. I can make
totally
a deal better than that.
Oh, yeah. But if you study his rhetoric and the stagecraft, there are a lot of parallels throughout history, and none of them particularly promising.
Yeah. So let's talk about immigration for a moment, and about big corporations and whether or not they're loyal to their workers, and switch to Dubuque for a moment, where a young guy is. His father has lost his job at, I believe, a meatpacking facility.
Yeah, meatpacking, yes.
Yeah, so the son kind of blames the corporations for giving the employees a raw deal, and the father says it's the immigrants. So you got a Sanders supporter in the son and a Trump supporter in the father?
Uh-huh. I don't think that's that unusual.
No.
I think there are probably a lot of those types of families. And one of the things that fascinated me about the son, who I really liked, was you know, another part of culture that I'm just too old to understand was punk rock music. But I, you know, once he told me that it was really punk rock that politicized him, I started studying the lyrics of a lot of, and the music of a lot of the sort of the icons of that movement. And there it is. I mean, a lot of the sort of, it's not just Bruce Springsteen that's writing about, you know, the trials of the working class, but a lot of it comes out of punk rock music.
Mm.
And that's what turned him. And his dad, who lost his job at the meatpacking, you know, a job that his father before that had had when the meatpacker left town. He sort of scrambled to find another job and got a small business job that turned him into a Republican.
So were you tooling around Iowa listening to punk rock?
To the best of my ability.
Were you really?
Yes.
That's great. You just imagine seeing you do that.
I did from Motown for my last book. Which
yeah, I know you did.
Punk rock, yeah.
And congratulations on winning the Robert Kennedy Award.
Thanks.
That was very, very nice. Yeah,
that's a meaningful thing.
Yes. I'm sure it is. David Marinus is our guest this hour, and he's authored a piece. It's a beautiful four-part series where actual, real heavy-duty reporting, lyrical reporting was done, looking for America. 35 days, he and his colleagues spent traveling all over the place, looking at supporters of various candidates and what their thoughts are about being an American. What does it mean to be an American? Where is the anger coming from? How do they see presidential candidates that they endorse trying to solve that anger and overcome that anger? What are the positions that are attracting certain people to certain candidates? It's a very wonderful look at what's going on right now, and seems like everything is up for grabs. David writes, it felt like the culmination of so many long emerging trends in American life, the decomposition of traditional institutions, descent of politics into reality TV entertainment, demographic and economic shifts, quickening the impulses of inclusion and exclusion and us versus them. This movement of great unsettling with the Republican Party unraveling, the Democrats barely keeping it together, and both moving farther away from each other by the week. We're welcoming phone calls for him. David is associate editor at the Washington Post and author of so many books, most recently Detroit, A Love Story, which just won the Robert F. Kennedy Book Award, and he's author of many other highly acclaimed books. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page, where we love to read your thoughts always, the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Lines are open for you and David Marinus right now. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And forgive me, I've been getting David's book, and it's a book that just won the Robert F. Kennedy Award. The book is Once in a Great City, a Detroit Story by David Marinus, winner of the Robert F. Kennedy Book Award, which was just recently given. So I wanted to get the name right. All right, our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Tom in Appleton is our first caller for you, David. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
Kathleen, I'd like to help you come to terms with why I've heard you say a number of times now that you don't know about shows like The Apprentice and things like that, and neither do I. And the reason you don't, and I think your guest probably falls in the same category, is because you're too intelligent to waste your time watching that garbage.
Well, I don't know what to make of that. Is it that we're too intelligent, David?
Well, I've watched some garbage in my life.
I never watched that one. Yeah.
But anyway, thank you for that.
I just don't like this, and there are put-down shows. There are other shows on TV. He did his thing, but this put-down of people is always bothering.
Yeah, it's humiliating, and that's part of what people like about it. So, I think there are other shows that might be classified as garbage, which are enjoyable sort of candy of some sort or another, but this is just humiliation.
Yeah. Now, Dancing with the Stars is another story, David. They can dance. I must tell you, I've watched that a few times. Thanks, Tom, very much for your call. Felicia in Sun Prairie, hi.
Hi. So my question for your guest was, I'm a guest Hispanic. My father's South American. I'm here legally in the country, and my question is about in the media. A lot of times we hear, Hispanic voters and Trump. But to me, I have no family here illegally that's Hispanic. Uh-huh. It doesn't affect me when I hear about illegal immigration or immigration policies. I don't think about it. So how do they make that connection between Hispanics and illegal voting or, black people and welfare? where do these connections come up, and are they real?
Well, I don't know that you would make a connection between black people and welfare, but you certainly can make a connection between Hispanics and Trump because of every single poll that's been conducted, whether it's the Pew Foundation or others that specialize in sort of surveying Hispanic sentiment, shows that by enormous majorities, and that doesn't mean it's everybody, and it might not be you, but it's well over 80% of Hispanics feel that immigration is an important issue, and that for the most part, depending on how it's worded, legislation that's considered anti-immigrant is also viewed as being anti-Hispanic. Hmm. And so that it's not just sort of an assumption. It's based on scientific study.
Felicia, do you care about the issue of immigration?
I mean, I do in a certain sense, but not the way it is right now in the media. That's not at all.
What
you
sense?
Know, the way it's being portrayed is not.
What sense? In what sense do you care about it?
Well, I'm Canadian, so I guess I'm an immigrant in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm Muslim. I'm a Muslim convert, so I have a lot of friends in the immigrant community. So in that sense, I'm extremely aware of immigration.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the Hispanic thing. Does that make sense? And they would say, like, for example, a lot of the food stamp issues here, then they would say African-American voters and this and that. And it gets to the point where, yeah, you might have a statistic that might show that 80% of African-Americans would vote for somebody who increases, you know, certain benefits, but that doesn't...
Right, I see your
point.
Do
you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
It just,
of course.
It constantly,
yeah, no, I get it. And it's not...
Yeah.
That's the problem with anything, is that once you find a majority feeling something, it tends to stereotype everybody. And one of the things I try to do in all of my work is to sort of go past those stereotypes. Mm. So I appreciate what you said.
Yeah, thank you so much. Talk about the young man, Turkish, I believe, and Muslim, who came to Iowa to campaign
from Milwaukee.
From Milwaukee, exactly,
yeah.
To campaign for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, it was too... So I was at the Clinton... canvassing headquarters, which was in a house in Dubuque, and in come two men and one of their sons, and I started, and they turned out to be from Turkey, immigrants, and one of them, who was the most talkative, you know, he told me about how he grew up in Turkey and was a nationally talented boxer, immigrated to the U.S., something like 17 years ago, and became very successful in Milwaukee eventually and in the Madison area, selling kitchen stone and various things. And so he thought that because he was a successful small businessman, he should support the Republicans. And he said that he was a supporter of Governor Walker. Until he started listening to Trump, and then he said to me, I realized I was on the wrong side.
Hmm.
So he and his friend drove from Milwaukee to Dubuque and spent the entire day, weekend, a Saturday with me. I mean, I was just watching them,
mm-hmm.
Canvassing in suburban Dubuque for Hillary.
Hmm. And the other two, in their 20s, supporters who were working for Hillary, the young woman was mostly because of her stance on women's issues?
Yeah, that was, two really smart young people in Dubuque who were running the Hillary canvassing there. And Allison Simpson, the young woman... She told me that she was a little bit embarrassed at first to be supporting Hillary because all of her friends were for Bernie,
mm-hmm.
So much so that she wouldn't post things on Facebook, and even some of her own siblings and relatives were for Sanders. But she felt very strongly because of women's issues that she should support Hillary, and so that's what drew her to Hillary. But both she and her boyfriend... who were the two key Hillary people in town, said they really were much more Obama people. But they felt that Hillary was the best one to extend the Obama legacy.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of rallies and support, how often did you see, we were talking to a young woman the first hour of the program who was at a Sanders rally near Los Angeles. She's covering Sanders right now and Clinton. Uh-huh. She made mention of this alliance between former anti-war protesters back in the 60s and 70s and Sanders supporters now. So we all know about the huge number of young people who are supporting Sanders, but a lot of older people, too, from that generation.
Well, you know, I think that's pretty split, actually. I think that's an exaggeration. I mean, a lot of the leaders of the movement in that era are for Hillary. Tom Hayden is for Hillary.
Right.
Todd Gitlin, the sociologist in New York, is for Hillary. And I found a lot of that, too. I mean, I wouldn't be so sure about that. I think, and certainly most of the women of that generation, I would say a slight majority are for Hillary over Bernie. I think it's the preponderance of Bernie supporters are the young people. And, I mean, there definitely are older counterculture people who are for Bernie, but what I found is that most of them were more sort of culturally counterculture and really dropped out of politics if they were ever in it during that era, but were more of the skeptical about politics completely, whereas people who were engaged in politics over those 40 years were, if they came out of the movement, were more likely to be for Hillary.
Interesting. Thanks, Felicia, for your call. Ellen in Madison. Hi.
Yeah, both this show and the last show, for some reason I find myself thinking about the charitable giving of current candidates, past candidates, and presidents, because for all the talk about, you know, how bad everything is, one of the personal characteristics that I look for are the finances of the people who are running and how they view charitable giving and the world that we live in. Self-disclosure, I'm a conservative. I would never, ever vote for Donald Trump, and I will not. I thought about voting for Hillary, but I just can't bring myself to do it. I'd love to see a third-party candidate. But the current Republicans, for example, who historically have been generous, like George Bush apparently gave more than 10% of his own personal income. Cruz gave less than 1%. Kasich gave less than 2%. Trump apparently gives none of his own money. Uses his foundation and does things like, you know, free golf games and stuff like that. Biden was 0.2%, Al Gore 0.2%. Sanders gives 4%, even though he himself is in the top 4% of wage earners. He has a tax rate of 13.5%. He owns two homes. I mean, I don't see him as any paragon, any example of, any outstanding example. And I mean, he's likable. He's a likable guy, but I can't vote for him either.
Well, that's an interesting set of statistics you have there. I know since I work at the Washington Post, we've done a lot of research on Trump, and most of what you cited there came from our reporting. And you're right; it has mostly to do with free golf at one of his golf courses. I don't think that you can judge, you know, one of the things I've always believed is that you can't judge generosity by ideology necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who can be very conservative who are very generous and people who are very liberal who are very stingy and vice versa. I mean, the policies you can judge, but the personal characteristics are much more unpredictable.
Thanks very much for your call, Ellen. Some emails and Facebook messages, David. One caller emailed, "The hatred and anger isn't over fear of one another, it's over fairness. You can't balance out the sins of the past, welfare, without upsetting others who feel that it isn't fair to them, those of us who work and don't get free stuff."
Well, the biggest welfare in America has been corporate welfare. So,
all right. Enough
said. I think that a lot of that anger is misdirected.
Jane sends this email. "No, not only is it fascinating to look at why people support someone like Donald Trump, what also needs to be looked at is why so many young people are attracted to a socialist such as Bernie Sanders. It would be interesting to find out how many of these people know what it is or how it has turned out in countries like Venezuela, or do these young people simply want someone else to pick up the tab for them?"
Well, I would say that to a large degree, these very young people came up after the era where socialism and communism were considered dirty words. It has none of the same resonance to people in their 20s than it did to earlier generations. So, you know, for better or worse, that's just a fact. And in terms of appeal of things that are beneficial to them, I mean, certainly one of Sanders' key platform issues is free college tuition for, you know, in public colleges. And that's, you know, the whole student debt issue is a major one. So that's appealing to their self-interest, as do a lot of ideas, good or bad.
Mm-hmm. Let's go, I think this is back in Iowa, let's go to the Evangelical Baptist preacher for a moment, because we have this, you know, every day now we've got news stories about transgender bathrooms. That's the mm-hmm. cultural issue that everybody's devoting time to. What was said from the pulpit there? What and how important is that vote?
Well, thanks for asking, because that gives me a chance to talk about my colleague, Robert Samuels, who spent time with that pastor in Dubuque. And Robert is a brilliant young African-American writer for The Post. And we did many things together and many things apart during our 35 days. So he spent time with that pastor. But basically what he was feeling is that all of these sociological, cultural, religious issues like transgender and gay rights and so on are turning away from his beliefs, and so he would speak out against them from the pulpit, and basically not very different from what his candidate Ted Cruz was saying.
Mm-hmm. And yet the country pretty remarkably is changing how it thinks about people who are gay, people who are transgendered. The transformation in those areas has been phenomenal in the past few years.
Yeah, and so the pastor was, and his friends were feeling that they were left behind, that they'd lost.
Hmm. So what do they do with that? They lost, so...
Well, that's a good question. I would like to go back and ask him what he's doing right now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the answer to that, but I you know, whether he was one of those evangelicals that followed this into Trump or is just, I think a lot of them I know are turning away from politics right now.
Mm-hmm.
And there is definitely a trend among certain segments of the evangelical population to just sort of retreat.
Hmm, interesting. You asked the question in the first piece, would the center hold as it usually does? Who is the center now? And it usually does hold. Will it hold now?
It hasn't.
Sure hasn't, has it?
No. So, I don't know what the center is, honestly. I don't know if anybody could define the center of the Republican Party right now, or even define the Republican Party. But to the extent that people who you might think would not support Trump are supporting him, like John McCain, who was,
Brent,
you know, vilified by Trump in
I
a
know,
humiliating
terribly.
Way.
Yes.
I would say that part of that is out of self-survival.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got a tough election. And part of it is trying desperately to hold something together and thinking that that's the only way to do it. But I think it's too late.
Mm. And going back to those people who still feel optimistic about the future and have no desire to go back, who represents optimism in this country, and why no desire on whoever those people's their part? Why it is the past?
Well, the most obvious ones are older African Americans who have gone through the whole gamut of race over, you know, the period from Jim Crow segregation through the civil rights movement to today. And despite all of the frustrations and imperfections in American society, can see the gains that they've made. And when people talk about making America great again, their question, you know, there was a elderly African-American woman I met in Las Vegas, you know, who said, great for whom? You know, and what was so great about the old days for us? So, mm-hmm. you know, that's a very strong sentiment among people who had suffered from the inequalities of the past.
David Marinus is our guest this hour. We're talking about a four-part series that recently ran in the Washington Post, Looking for America. David and his colleague from the Washington Post visited many different places in the country and talked with people of various political persuasions, not only to find out who they were supporting, but what were the issues that were shaping the way they view the country right now. Were they angry? What were they angry about? How did that translate into political affiliation and action, actually? What about those people who felt the past wasn't very great and feel as though that we are making progress? Who are those people? And what happened to the center? It's interesting what David just said. Looks like there isn't. They asked the question, would the center hold as it usually does? There doesn't appear to be a center right now. Well, it's a very, very well done series, four parts. It will be on our Facebook page in case you missed it. It's worth your reading. There are certain things that you really want to read. Perhaps instead of watching reality TV, you may want to read this series. It'll stay with you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. David is author most recently of a book that won the Robert F. Kennedy Book Award just recently, Once in a Great City, A Detroit Story. He's author of a number of other books. Wonderful book about Vietnam. If you've never read it, it's definitely worth reading. They Marched into Sunlight. He's also author of Barack Obama, The Story, When Pride Still Mattered, A Life of Vince Lombardi, First in His Class, A Biography of Bill Clinton, Clemente, The Passion and Grace of Baseball's Last Hero, and other books as well. He is our guest this hour. And he actually lives in Madison some of the year and is a graduate of UW-Madison. Two more phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Marinus is our guest this hour. Let's go back to phone calls. Lori in Crawford County. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I would like Mr. Marinus to comment on Bernie Sanders' popularity in rural counties. He did very well out here in southwestern Wisconsin. We don't have a large college population of any sort. I've seen him doing well in other rural places in the rest of the country. I'm wondering what your comments are about that.
Yeah, I think I wasn't trying to limit Bernie's popularity to just college students or college places. He's basically trounced Hillary in almost all of rural America, particularly white rural America. He's not doing well in southern rural areas that are predominantly African American, primarily because those people tend to know the Clintons and don't know Bernie at all. But I think that I'm not trying to diminish his appeal at all. I think that part of it is Clinton fatigue, and part of it is the clarity with which Bernie talks and can frame issues that are meaningful to rural America.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Lori, very much for your call. Another Lori in Madison this time. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thanks very much, Kathleen. I guess my call picks up on what the previous caller was suggesting. You know, Bernie Sanders' campaign, at least to me, picks up very strongly on a movement that we saw here in Wisconsin with the hundreds of thousands of people. Well, not hundreds of thousands, sorry, exaggeration. It was 100,000 some people who were able to gather collectively at the state capitol. And, you know, the issues that people who participated in that were advocating were things like the right to collectively bargain, have a voice in one's position in work, pensions, et cetera, et cetera. These are perhaps socialist values in a sense, but at the same time they come directly out of the New Deal and out of the progressive tradition. And they won widespread support. The Democratic Party chose not to run on those issues, but Bernie Sanders has chosen to run on those issues. And I'd like to suggest that there is a political consensus that can be found there, at least
know about consensus, but I agree with everything else you said. I think that those are American values that were represented there. I think that the divide is not so much over ideology, although that's part of it, but more over which is the best way to win. And as strong as that movement was in Wisconsin several years ago, you could blame it on not following it completely in the elections to as the reason that the Democrats didn't win, but I think it was more than that. You know, they got trounced by Walker twice or three right. times. And so some people react to that by saying that we weren't pure enough, and some by saying we have to be more practical. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I wouldn't say that there's a consensus there, but I would say it's a very strong and important strain in progressive thought in America and mm-hmm. in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Laurie, for your call. Let's talk about some of the economic angst. I think it was a guy in Michigan, I believe, was a Trump supporter who was talking about you used to be able to buy a ranch house, you know, for $6,000. That was a while ago now. But this, I think people are really feeling enormous economic strain in this country in all kinds of places, and you certainly found many of those people. Where did they go with that politically, David?
Well, people can be, my feeling about most people who are not really political is that they can be moved by to their better instincts or their worst instincts.
Oh, interesting.
And so where they go politically depends to some degree on who's doing the most persuasive appealing to them at that point for the better or worse. So I think it's up in the air, and a lot of them are going to Trump, and a lot of them are going to Sanders. And, you know, if you did a Venn diagram, there'd be just a little slice that they can meet in the middle, but they're really very different strains in American life. One is nativist and the other is progressive, but some of the same symptoms are evident in both.
And as you traveled talking to so many people in so many places, did you find, or are we making too much of this, that people are having a really hard time making ends meet?
No, a lot of people are having a hard time making ends meet, and it's particularly the working and middle class that are suffering. I mean, the wealth is there, and it's... It's just, you know, I mean, what Sanders says about the 1% is right. I mean, that divide has gotten larger and larger. You know, that's not to say that everything is doom and gloom. I mean, if you go to cities, even Detroit, the city that I've known best over the last few years, which was sort of the symbol of urban decay, there are a lot of great things going on. I'm sure that's true in Milwaukee, too. I mean, so you see this vibrance in American cities now, which sort of runs counter to the notion that everything is going down
yes.
the drain.
Mm-hmm.
They're both true. At the same time, it's just different groups. I mean, if you go to a lot of rural areas in the South or in New England, you'll find whole small towns devastated by opioid addiction,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
mm-hmm.
that's, you know, a large degree a sense of hopelessness.
Right.
So that's going on, too.
Peter is next in Sauk County. Hi, Peter.
Thank you so much. I agree with your speaker. There is no center. The issues have been framed in such a way that they have been stretched so far apart to the extreme that we see on one hand people representing the progressive nature of what Bernie Sanders is promoting, stretched on the other side by Donald Trump and what he seems to be representing. All of that used to be the middle, and it represents utter frustration, anger, disappointment with the system, a recognition that the system works for nobody but the 1%. I have great concerns, both as an elected official in Sauk County and in Baraboo on the school board, of how our citizens are interpreting these issues, and how through various forms of behavioral economics and psychology, people are divided around single issues that really don't do any good for us as communities. So we must reclaim that center by reminding people of what are the single most important things that American values all agree on, and stop with the divisiveness. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call, David.
Well, that's a very strong viewpoint, valid viewpoint. I think in my opinion, it's not an even argument. I think that over the last 20 years, and particularly in the last few years, the Republican Party has moved into a place that makes it much harder for that to be reached.
And is it disintegrating, the Republican Party, David?
It's going to be, we'll know in a few months.
Yes, so.
It sure appears that way.
Yeah. Jane in Phillips. Hi, Jane. Jane, are you there? Jane isn't there. Tim in Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if maybe Bernie just didn't get in the race early enough. What I mean by that is, how do we think he would fare if those early contests were held today? Is there any sort of polling that shows, you know, the first handful of contests, how he's doing compared to how he was during their election?
That's a good question. I think that I don't have a scientific answer to that. My sense is that it has more to do with geography and demographics than chronology of the elections. But you know, it's an interesting question you raise.
Thanks, Tim. Frank in Milwaukee. Oh, wait a second. Hi, Frank. Hi.
Thank you, Kathleen. By the way, I talked to you many times at Barnes & Noble. Anyway, when I was a student at UW-Madison, you know the students were all from McGovern. And you know what happened to McGovern. Today's students, now they are for Bernie Sanders. And I think it's going to happen to the students the same thing which happened to me when I voted for McGovern.
Well, some people feel that way, and that's why they might vote for Hillary. Others feel that you should vote for who you consider most closely represents what you believe in, and that's why you voted for McGovern, and why a lot of people are voting for Bernie Sanders.
Hmm. Do you wrestle at all with this Donald Trump thing? Is just so out there that it's hard to figure out what to do with it. Do you wrestle with how in the world you as a journalist are going to cover all of this, David? And what
absolutely.
No,
it's a conundrum. And
it is.
You can't ignore him, but he's set up he's manipulated the system so that anytime you give him any publicity, it doesn't matter what it's about, negative or positive, he benefits from it or seems to. But there are certain things you can do. I mean, I think that television in particular has gone way over the edge.
Right.
Glorifying his landing of his airplane, you know,
right.
Like it's the second coming. That's preposterous. It's not journalism's finest hour.
Yeah, and covering every single campaign speech, the whole thing,
Yeah,
network after network after network.
And they're doing it because you know, people are watching it. They're getting ratings. So it's not all their fault. There's some, you know, there's an addictive quality to it, too, whether you love him or hate him.
Right. Well, at least you got out on the road, and all indications are that it was a really good experience for you, and thank you for doing it. It's just a solid piece of work, but then again, everything you do is a solid piece of work. You're a gifted guy. You're doing the right thing with your life, don't you think?
Well, we're heading to Madison later this week, so always the right thing.
Good. Glad to hear that. Thanks, yeah. David.
Okay, Kathleen.
Thanks.
Great talking with you.
Yeah, and you as well. David Marinus, the piece, it's a four-part series in the Washington Post, and one of those pieces of journalism that will forever be associated with what was going on in America in 2016. The piece is Looking for America. David, of course, is lives in Madison for a good chunk of the year. He's associate editor at the Washington Post. His latest book just won the Robert F. Kennedy Award, which is a big deal. Once in a Great City, we interviewed him last time about that book, A Detroit Story. David is also author of a number of other books. He is a three-time Pulitzer Prize finalist and won the Pulitzer for National Reporting in 1993 for coverage of then-presidential candidate Bill Clinton. So we thank him so much for being with us. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour and to KP Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee where the sun is shining. It's a beautiful day. I hope the same is true wherever you happen to be. Until tomorrow.